The longest day of the year has passed. The days grow shorter. The nights grow longer. Winter's coming. That's how it works in the world of impermanence. Continuing to explore, question and investigate the mystery of death and dying. Let us remain open, watching carefully our own minds and how we easily interpret many things. We jump to conclusions. It's a significant time in a person's life, of course. All the emotions that come with that, and with the emotions, it's interesting to look at, for example, if there's a lot of grief and sadness, is it for ourselves or for that person? Or for the Sangha or something like that? I think we often like to think, oh, it's all about them. It's like, how so sad that they won't exist in the way that we're used to them existing. But maybe not so sad for them, actually, right? We have to start looking at how we might be projecting that. Robert Thurman talking about nothingness, with the modern materialist view of, well, after death there's nothing. And he points out the way that, well, we can't actually, it doesn't make sense to be afraid of nothing. What we're afraid of actually is suffering. And that might be in a very subtle form of making nothing into our idea of nothing as some kind of place of nothingness that we go that sounds horrible. But truly, nothing is beyond happy and unhappy and so on. This is an earlier talk where he was speaking of how it maybe doesn't make so much sense, this idea that there's nothing after. And if so, then why would we have a problem? And then there's the emotions of ourselves, loss of a dear loved one, a teacher. Interestingly, I find for myself, when I first heard about Catherine's accident on Monday, I felt a lot of strong emotion at that time. When I heard that she's probably not going to make it, I felt this loss. I think it was more personal, like, oh, she's such a beautiful person that I'm kind of like still getting to know. And my greatest, I feel like, most wondrous times with her actually were maybe in the last half year. Shoho and I took Catherine out to dinner maybe just like a month or so ago, and then went back to her house for dessert, and we stayed up hours, like way past midnight. I'm like, don't older people go to sleep? Like, we gotta go to sleep. She just really heartfelt, talking about Dharma and life and practice. And now I feel, you know, there's phases of these things, right? Today, anyway, I feel some don't know if it's exactly happiness. There was one, you know, it's, we can also investigate all our ways of death is like this serious thing. We have to be, it's somber, sad, and serious. So don't be too lighthearted around it. And see, well, where does that come from? I was kind of in that space the other day when somebody who regularly comes to Zazen, I thought she probably hadn't heard and about the news about Catherine. So I told her in a kind of like, have you heard about Catherine? Yeah. And she was like, no, but that's great. I was like, she's like, that's so beautiful. I feel her with us. I felt her presence in Zazen here. And her just like total light. And like, she's just on her journey going, like, I have no worries about her at all. Like, how wonderful for her. What a blessing that she's on this mysterious, magnificent journey. I was like, oh. You know, she really, for me, that was great. Just such a surprise. Like, oh, maybe I'm just falling into the way I think I should be. Maybe not much more from Robert Thurman, because we don't want Johnny to get up and go. But a little bit more, just for his practice. Yeah. This is, you know, along the same lines, right? There's the stories of the Buddhist tradition, many of them, and from the earliest sutras on to modern times, about this process. So, was the Buddha just going along with like stuff in his culture? Every culture, every spiritual tradition has teachings about this significant time of death. Maybe the Buddha thought, this is just, like we were discussing yesterday, this is not that important, it's just the practice is just to be present, and even I, the Buddha, don't know what's going on there, so let's just be present. But people want stories from spiritual traditions, and since we looks like there's some Buddhism starting around here in India, maybe I'll have to die myself first for it to be called Buddhism. But we should have some stories about this, or no one will want to be a Buddhist. He probably didn't think that way, but he might have. Or did he actually, with his insight, see that there's a whole process here that we can practice with in between life to life and in between lives? We vow from this life on throughout countless lives to hear the true Dharma, Dogen says, we just chanted. So we have, you know, the six realms of birth, our Buddhist story, and the human realm is just one of the realms, nothing special, really, right? One of the six. It's kind of in the middle, too. It's not at the top or the bottom, the human realm, and then in this cosmology, literal or metaphorical, and down below, and we mean by below, I don't think we mean physically, but we mean like in terms of happiness and unhappiness. We have these hungry ghosts that we fed the other day in our ceremony, dominated by dissatisfaction and desire. We have the hell realm dominated by anger and hatred, cold, effects of anger. And then the animal realm, of which, you know, we're animals, but non-human animals don't have the capacity, cannot receive subtle teachings about practice the way that we can. So it's more difficult going. And they're said to be dominated by fear of being eaten by one another. And then the human realm, where all these kind of emotions are all kind of mixed together in a nice, equalized balance, where it's hard enough that we have reason to practice, and it's easy enough that we can practice. In the hell realms, they don't have zendos like this. And then we have the God realm up above, in the sense that the long happiness, very, very long lifespans in the cosmology. And then we have the God wannabes, the fighting titans who are not quite in the God realm, but would like to be. And it's kind of like the upper middle class. It's not quite like the super wealthy, but likes to watch them on TV and fantasize about having the huge Hollywood estate. Those are like the asuras. So we often, I think in America especially, we say, but these are all, so that's the kind of dominated by jealousy, right? That negative emotion. So the five afflictive emotions that we experience every day, cycling through these realms, and we tend to say it's a beautiful and, story of ourselves and our life. Yeah. And is it just about this life, or is it possible to be born into these realms for long times? And I personally am open to this possibility that, again, from experiences I've had in this life, where there's some other, I would call, non-human realms, as a human, that are possible to venture into, that I'm quite convinced that there are other realms, not just emotional states of the human realm. And we have the teaching of mind only. So when we say other realms, they're never apart from our mind. If we're in a hell realm that really seems to be existing as a hell realm, not the human realm, that's our mind's creation. It's never apart from mind, just as the human world is not apart from mind. So this is maybe worth looking at, just as we continue to explore for a while more these mind-only teachings, right? It doesn't mean that that it's exactly like a dream. It's very dreamlike, but we're all co-creating. We're co-creating a mentally projected world according to mind only. And it's very real. And I think in these other realms, it's possible to see how this human created realm seems very real, solid, and like the only one there is. Maybe that's the point. Most important point. It seems like when we're in this, it seems like it's the, how could there be anything else? But if you're in another realm, you can see how, there could be different realms, and they're all mind created, and not just by so-called me, right? not solipsistically created. It's not just like I am the only mind in the universe, co-created by different beings of these particular realms due to certain causes and conditions. Anyway, Robert Thurman says, some Asian teachers have said in recent decades that the horrid states of like hells and hungry ghosts are simply metaphorical and not to be taken literally, that they merely indicate states of mind to be avoided. There is some truth to that, of course, especially since the whole universe also consists of states of mind. It was also practical of those teachers in that their students, Westerners with a certain background and education, might have been frightened away from an edifying path of learning and meditation by the prospect of the crackling brimstone fires of hell they thought they'd long ago escaped. I think that's true, you know. American Buddhism is grounded and thriving on our very modern scientific worldview, which I think makes it stronger. But we don't want to be limited to any one view. But in the final analysis, the metaphorical approach is misleading, and it no longer is quite so necessary. All the world is in some sense created by the mind, from the infinitely positive to the infinitely negative. If you step out in front of a freight train, its painful crushing of you is all in the mind as well. A liberated person, and these kind of statements, I think what he means here is completely liberated from the slightest belief in the sense of a separate self. Right? Stakes are high here. This such a liberated person, viscerally aware of the precise sense of just being mind, would have no problem standing in front of such a train if there were any benefit for beings from doing so. They wouldn't just randomly step out there just to test if it's mind. But if it's like, maybe I could sacrifice this body and mind of this life to benefit others. Again, it's hard to imagine that for us not completely liberated minds. But I have some sense that I'll go with that. I don't think he's making a exaggerated, ridiculous statement of the impossible. But it takes a person of such ability to ignore the possibility of hell. So this is his point here. This, if we can see the train coming at us as a dream, or unless we can see that train coming at us as not really real in the way we think it is and just mind, unless we're such a person, we maybe shouldn't ignore the possibilities of other appearances like trains, such as hell, hungry ghosts, animal realm, or even the worst form of human life without freedom and opportunity for practice. It's more healthy for the rest of us to fear being crushed by freight trains. This is good. Good fear.
Yes. Are you saying living or leaving this life? And the sentence just before.
So it takes a person of such ability to be, walk in front of a freight train, to ignore the possibility of these realms, even the worst forms of human life without freedom and opportunity. It's more, so that's the sentence. I don't know what it was that you heard. It's more healthy for the rest of us to fear being crushed by freight trains. I think he's just talking about us living now too, you know.
Pre-freight train.
Pre-freight train life. But it's healthy to fear being crushed by freight trains if we're not completely seen through the veils of this world, right? it gives us energy to get out of their way. It's good in the conventional world. Therefore, it's also healthy for us to fear letting negativities go unchecked because of the infinitely negative consequences they can produce. It gives us energy to nip negativities in the bud. So it's just as a kind of reasoning here, I thought it's kind of interesting. It makes sense to me that in the conventional world, where as long as we believe in freight trains, then that are appearing very real, then can we be open to believing in other appearances of realms? And again, it might be like if we haven't experienced it, it maybe seems fanciful, but can we be open to all kinds of appearances? And then practice well in accord with appearances. Our practice actually takes place in the conventional world of appearances. If anger is consuming us, we can actually conventionally practice relaxing, letting go, taking a deep breath. These are conventional practices. There's the ultimate practice of just seeing that anger is completely empty, but that's not at the expense of the conventional practices. I think in order to realize the ultimate truth, we must be completely grounded in the conventional truth, as Nagarjuna says. And the conventional truth, according to this Buddha Dharma worldview, is things like six realms. And rebirth and karma are not ultimate teachings, but they are conventional teachings offered by the Buddha as helpful to us now in this life. So if we're going to use the science of death to develop the art of dying well, we must realize that all these realms need to be considered just as real as our present lives in the human realm. Just as real means like not completely real, but just as real as this. Those who have remembered their own previous lives have reported this to be the case, and it makes logical sense that the life forms in the ocean of evolution would be much more numerous than just the number of species on this one tiny little material planet we can see around us nowadays. So the encouragement provided by the "it's all in your mind" approach can be useful, but we should remember that it cannot be applied selectively to those aspects of reality we don't like. And it's interesting. I mean, he's just trying to make this one point. We could say, but I haven't seen these fiery cauldrons, so that's different from this book. I can see it, right? Well, just look closely. Let's continue to keep looking. All of reality is mind, and mind has us experience it as out there. So we should still take care to see to it that out there is beautiful and not horrible, to prevent the horrible and develop the beautiful. So just a little taste of where this book is going, right? The liberation, instructions for liberation in the between lives. It's basically the instructions are that, in Tibetan tradition, this is being read to someone after they've, we call clinically have died, but there is a consciousness around the body. And, this is one tradition. And the instructions are, "Hey, noble child." Hey. Robert Dearman translates. "Whatever terrifying visions of the reality between may dawn upon you, you should not forget the following words. You must proceed remembering in your mind the meaning of these words. This is the key. The words are, hey, now when the reality between dawns upon me, I will let go of the hallucinations of instinctive terror, enter the recognition of all objects as my mind's own visions, and understand this as the pattern of perception in the between. Come to this moment, arrived at the most critical cessation, I will not fear my own visions of deities mild and fierce. In the dreamlike world of the between. So that's the gist of this manual. It goes on, you know, for 49 days with more and more detailed instructions, but they all come back to the same point again and again. Is this is my mind. Just keep remembering, this is not an external reality causing this terror and distress. This is projections of mind. This is projections of mind, like a dream. And possible to be free, completely liberated in the between, where the visions are particularly vivid. So, moving back to Soto Zen, we have Suzuki Roshi, Nirvana, the waterfall. A little bit from here, which, see, maybe this is not so different. He says, before we were born, we had no feeling. We were one with the universe. This is called mind only, in quotes. I never noticed that before. Before we were born, and we could talk about when I hear this, I hear like into this life, and I also hear moment to moment, born as a person out of non-duality, you could say. We might be totally settled, really settled into Zazen, where we're actually not a person, right? And then the bell rings. Kinhin. We suddenly are born as a person, right? So before we were born, we had no feeling in this samadhi or in this, you know, pre-life. We were one with the universe. This is called mind only, or essence, nature of mind, or big mind. After we are separated by birth from this oneness, as the water falling from the waterfall is separated by the wind and rocks, then we have feeling. You have difficulty because you have feeling. You attach to the feeling you have without knowing just how this kind of feeling is created. Interesting that he singles out that one particular skandha, you could say, of feeling. Like almost like our life in the human world as individuals is so dominated, isn't it, by feeling pleasant and unpleasant. And that's why we have difficulty. You attach to the feeling you have without knowing just how this kind of feeling is created. When you do not realize that you are one with the river or one with the universe, you have fear. Whether it's separated into drops or not, water is water. Our life and death are the same thing. When we realize this fact, we have no fear of death anymore, and we have no actual difficulty in our life. When the water returns to its original oneness with the river, it no longer has any individual feeling to it. It resumes its own nature and finds composure. How very glad the water must be to come back to the original river. Okay. How very glad. Yeah, it's funny. It's funny almost because he's kind of saying that in that realm there's no feeling, but he can't help himself saying, well, it must be the glad. Yeah. If this is so, what feeling will we have when we die? I think we're like the water in the dipper being poured back into the river. We will have composure then, perfect composure. It may be too perfect for us just now because we're so much attached to our own feeling, to our individual existence. For us, just now, we have some fear of death, but after we resume our true original nature, there's nirvana. That's why we say to attain nirvana is to pass away. To pass away is not a very adequate expression. Perhaps to pass on, to go on, to join would be better. Will you try to find some better expression for death? When you find it, you will have quite a new interpretation of your life. It will be like my experience when I saw the water in that big waterfall at Yosemite. Imagine! It was 1,340 feet high. Nirvana, the waterfall. So, we're also, this is she looking at the teachings of Venerable Karin Sobun Daiosho, who's teaching us right now, I think, as we were saying yesterday, for those of us sitting with her, there's a mutual thing where we may be supporting her by our energy of sitting there with us, and she is like teaching Dharma to us in the most straightforward and uncontrived and authentic way possible without the clunkiness of words and language and all this. And I sense, and I don't know, but I have the intuitive sense that she would appreciate us making this process of hers into a practice exploration. She's, her whole life is given to practice and helping people open to everything. So she says in 1997, what we're studying is the mind, not Catherine's mind, the mind arising as Catherine. And when Catherine can hear and accept everything that's going on in her mind, she can hear and accept everything that's going on in anybody's mind. Nothing is outside her mind. In that mind, there is no pressure to improve Catherine. It is to be without anxiety about non-perfection. From that place, there's no anxiety about right or wrong, and yet there's complete understanding of causes and consequences. Someone said recently that she noticed that when she comes close to something important, she veers off. This is an important awareness. What does it take to go straight ahead? To notice the moments when we veer off. How much effort is enough? What's too hard? Our life can be measured in moments of backing off or going straight ahead. Backing off of conflict, of difficulty, frustration, fear, or willingness to trust and go with the moment. Not because it's comfortable, but because it's here. So, with such dharma that she knows, may she be facing this moment completely right now. When we're most completely ourselves, we're most completely free of ourselves. But you can't think about it. You have to completely be the complicated, mysterious being that each of us is and is embarrassed by. Is there anyone here who's not embarrassed by the completely enigmatic, mysterious being you are? It's great. As long as we're embarrassed, there is a self there. There's a defense and some resistance. But how about willing to be embarrassed, to be resistant, to be either? it's like my previous talk brought up was that there's a self and a no self at the same time. The self is there's an embarrassed one, and then there's a non-embarrassed one, right? At the same time. Too embarrassed. Well, you should know there's one who's not embarrassed. Fear is like desire. Try satisfying desire sometime. See what happens. The more we feed it, the more it expands. It's wonderful that you can see that fear is pervasive and keeps arising. What's the only thing you can do when fear is here right in front of you? And the student says, well, you teach us to look at it. And Catherine says, yes, stop veering off. You have to go into it. You have to take a little step toward it. Then take another little step. You go as slowly as you need to. You might come right in and put your nose down close to it. But maybe you don't want to get that close. You can only do what your stomach can do. So you do it slowly at the pace at which your stomach and your heart can handle it. When we get really tight and solid, so does the energy of fear. If you become relaxed and just sit there with fear, inhaling and exhaling, fear is going to relax too. It might change shape, might get smaller or bigger, but it's never going to be bigger than you because it's your energy. That's a good one, huh? Like fear can't overwhelm you and completely take you over. It can't get bigger than you because it is your energy. It maybe can get right to that point. I think so. But it can't actually consume you completely because it is you. Fear is never greater than our body. So what we have to do when our heart is ready and our mind and stomach is ready is to get up close inside it, breathe it, smell it. Mind has to bring fear back into the body because it's the mind that puts fear outside. It's the mind that says, I'm not going to acknowledge that fear or work with it. You allow your consciousness to experience sensation and you stay with it. You don't go someplace else in your mind and wish it would go away. You enter the experience with an inhalation, with an exhalation. You feel the coldness, the movement, the solidity, or the dissolution with a quiet, steady mind. This is the practice of non-duality, entering into whatever presents itself. This is the study of the body. Study sensations with your breath, with your awareness, with your stomach, with your mind. Know them from the inside. Know them as your mind. And then see what happens. Any thoughts arise? Questions or reflections? How to meet the great unknown of each moment. Fear is quite natural when we don't understand what's happening. And yet, the heart of the practice of Zen, according to Bodhidharma, is just not knowing. How could it be possible to not know without fear, or at least not know with complete willingness to not know? Yes, Kathy?
Well, several things. I am glad you read the teaching where she talked about spelunk.
Mm-hmm.
That just reminds me of vintage Catholic, you know.
Very into the body.
Very much so, and about like taking it to your stomach, or being in your stomach, and that, I forget sometimes. I just take my practice for granted, and I don't necessarily always realize the origin of the way I practice.
Mm.
You know, and when I hear something like that, I'm like, oh, I know why I practice the way I practice, because, you know, that's the teaching that formed me. When I was going, what is this? That's what I heard. So I think that's sometimes why I fight with my yoga, because I'm like, but what about this stomach?
The stomach only school. Not different.
Why not have the school of stomach only?
Yes, the stomach only tradition. Yeah, and it occurs to me, I mean, stomach might be different people associate anxiety maybe with different, like, lungs or heart or stomach. Maybe that was her particular experience, I thought, or even at the time. But then I thought, well, really, though, in Zen tradition, Zen is kind of a stomach school, actually. We call it the hara, or the tanden, and we say, really feel your energy down here and ground your heady experience when energy gets too high. Anxiety often tends to be rising, breathing down.
And Suzuki Roshi also, in his Sangha Kaya teaching, he uses the analogy of eating food and digesting, that the food is separate in its form, and that the merging is digestion. And how, again, we think it's this big, mysterious, hard-to-understand thing. But he says it's like digestion. You know, we do it all the time. Our stomach is different. I think, I don't know if it's in this book. I think it's in his Branch of Spoons book.
So we become one with food.
Yeah, and just the way that it, you know, the separate, it merges.
Yeah.
And it's still all the separate food, but it's, you know, when it comes out.
it becomes our cells and our body. And I think fear can often be in the stomach. You know, I have a gut response that I can't go there. Yes.
Speaking of fear and how we divert ourselves, and we don't even recognize oftentimes. In Dokusan this morning, we were talking, and then the question arose, what is Buddha? And it just arose as if I went to this place of there must be one answer. You know, I fear arose. And so I moved on.
Yeah, I noticed that.
But
I didn't notice that you noticed.
I came back to see. And then it arose interesting. What went on there? Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you for bringing that back. Maybe she just didn't hear me. And that moment's gone, and now we're into something else, so that's fine. So
I'm not sure on myself.
Now we relive it.
Yeah.
Thank you. Hi.
Whatever's going on, so then we can walk.
Yeah. And to and the people that there's a wonderful atmosphere over there in general of quiet, stillness, and yet to wait for a lot of us to come and really sit unmoving is kind of like a response to Catherine. Like there's something it's like it's the most, just as she's maybe offering the most authentic direct teaching, the most authentic direct response is not like it feels to me right now is not even so much like, I wonder if she needs something, maybe we should roll her over. Those are necessary things too, but just wordlessly non-doing with her, non-doing. And we get to see all our projections, like when she's breathing along and she takes that really big and there's that moment, that charged moment of like, that's it. I mean, there were a couple of those yesterday. And then half a minute later, continue. Yeah.
I'd like to speak in praise of hell.
Please praise hell.
Yeah. I try not to demonize bad emotions anymore.
That's appropriate.
I say it this way. If my smoke alarm knows before I do that my bed's on fire, I don't want it to sing me a lullaby. And so I see fear and anger and jealousy and shame and all these things as smoke alarms. And when I started thinking it that way, I've never, looking back and even now, I don't recall any time when I was really afraid that I wasn't future casting.
Oh yeah, fear is completely based on the future. Yeah.
At any time I really had resentment that I wasn't past casting.
Yeah.
Any time I wasn't envious or jealous or shame, I wasn't in my neighbor's business. And so a lot of people I know take pills for this stuff. But I decided to listen to the smoke alarm. And if I am really afraid of something, it's because I'm future casting. I have to get back to this moment.
So yeah.
These negative, so-called negative emotions, afflictive emotions, are actually just giving me a kind of GPS fix as to how to get home. Get home, get here from the future.
Yeah,
get
so
here from the past.
That's a great practice,
get
I think,
here
too. Mm-hmm. Yeah, using them to show you where you're at as like, it's feedback to, you could even say this Buddha's most kind of core teaching, right? All suffering and in the form of these afflictive emotions or whatever we call them, is based on grasping something, on some form, some root holding. And you could say that's what the smoke alarms are showing you, the particular color of grasping, whether it's the future, the past, another, as an other, or all these, they're all different types. So I think that's beautiful practice. And we might even say that even in these stories, in this manual for the between, it's kind of like using the terrifying and beatific visions to point back to this, to, you could say, the core root grasping of there's a world outside this mind. So I think that's very true. And there's times when sometimes those emotions are so strong that we forget all about the practice. I mean, I think that's the best vow and intention we can have is like, may I be able to meet the deepest hell as an alarm, as a smoke alarm, to see what I'm holding on to. There may be realms where that are too advanced for our practice, in which case, let's not try to live there all the time. So I think that's part of hell too, is like, we don't really have the total choice. We're going to end up there sometimes. And when we do, then let's use it as a smoke alarm. But we can, in the most conventional and simple, mundane view of things, it's like, let's make a world that's like, and a life for ourselves and others that's with as little hellishness as possible. And then when it comes, then we have a practice. Thank you for that. Yes, Patrick.
This is probably very original. When you just said a bit ago about the mystery of each moment, I know that there's a mystery, but we don't know. Of course, you were referencing, you really don't know about death or fardos. And I imagine that I kind of always glaze over the expression of fardos and choosing our parents. I don't have such a strong feeling that Johnny does, but I do kind of glaze over. But for some reason, I certainly accept, the value of the mind, and certainly have the experience of not being able to predict. That's very clear to me. So this idea of facing the mystery of each moment with don't know mind has been relieved me of suffering, and I think the amount of suffering in the world goes down. I don't cause as much suffering. You might even stay close to that don't know mind.
Yeah.
And Dogen kind of offered this kind of thinking about Pascal Bardin. Dogen, I think taking refuge in Buddha Dhamma and Sangha, he would be suffering in that same way that I talked about mine and others. Maybe I can do that up until I fall into kind of like capital. If I've got any kind of idea that consciousness is bigger than this body, maybe not bardo or something else. It'd be nice if my last breath were about refuge in Sangha. This is also, I hope, that my thoughts. If I can't accept Bardo, I can at least accept mystery. And I've got a practice to sit with the mystery.
And it also, I heard in there too, that it sounds like you accept cause and effect, in the sense that things, when I practice don't know mind, things seem to go better, and the effects, there are effects of that practice. So which is, that's, I would say that's a way of talking about karma. And you could also say that don't know mind is taking refuge in Buddha, or taking refuge in don't know mind would be one interpretation of refuge in Buddha, is that which is free from all fixed views.
To finish, I mean, this is still my, you know, wrestling with that term, you know, preparation.
Mm-hmm.
And if I make it, you know, like in calculus where you make the interval infinitely small, if I'm just being willing to accept the mystery in this moment,
yes.
then it's not too big of a calculation.
Yes. It's just another, yeah. We often also talk about it as in this life, each moment is like a birth and a death. There's like a, I mean, this is even, you know, Abhidharma from the old days is actually what's happening is there's an arising due to a previous moment. There's a cessation of, you know, a whole experience. There's an arising of five skandhas, and there's a cessation of five skandhas. Just a moment later, you could say that's like death. All five skandhas just ceased. But due to the particular configuration of five skandhas, that forms the condition for immediately a new moment of arising, five more skandhas. So we didn't even notice the gap, but arising and ceasing, birth, death, birth, death, birth, death, this whole body-mind experience is being born and dying every moment. And my understanding of that teaching is what we call death is just another one. It's just, like you say, it's just right, we're practicing right up, and then there's that one particular moment. There's a cessation, and then there's just that, the five skandhas are no, particularly the form skandha, suddenly becomes unlinked from the mental skandhas in one particular moment. But it's a particular moment. I mean, according to the teachings too, it's not like a blurry, drawn out moment. There's no such thing as drawn out moments. There's only a moment. Yes.
Well, yeah, and you know, your description of listening to her breath, I mean, having been with a couple of other people when they died, that's all it is. It's just that, oh, that was it. You know, and there's all this, you know, all of our drama and our mystery and our fear and all that, and obviously if a person had some trauma, I think it's a different story, but in her case, you know, hopefully her moment of trauma was shortened, but, you know, hopefully she didn't suffer too much. Hopefully she blacked out right away or whatever. But now, clearly, you know, there's no suffering. And so really, it's just a moment. That's all it is. It's just, there's the breath, and then there's nothing.
Yeah. Yeah. And then is where we don't know what happens.
And then
the following moment.
We enter our ritual.
Yeah.
Reality that we do for ourselves and to honor,
mm-hmm.
you know, the person. But the very moment, it's just exactly what you said.
I've been looking into lots of the Soto Zen ceremonial manuals for the numerous ritual enactments and celebrations that are done particularly for the passing of a venerable abbot. And one of the statements that's made kind of early, like the announcement, everything is of course in the old days very formalized, so the formal announcement that now we would maybe send out like on email or something, which we have, right? But it says something like, you know, for venerable Sobun, the wind and fire elements have become like unbalanced in a way that like it's kind of like a hopeless case. The way the elements have become so disordered, and so that's what's happening. I don't remember exactly what it said, but it almost struck me as kind of funny that it's just this matter of fact kind of description of like. It might even be like in the first person for when someone, the person is really ill, they send out a notice. It says, excuse me, Sangha, my fire and wind and four elements are imbalanced and to the point where like they can't be dealt with anymore. Sorry. It's kind of like that's just how the four elements work in the elemental world.
Yeah, but I mean, no mind to disagree with venerable teachings, but you know, it doesn't feel like there's something out of order.
Well, out of order means like for our usual human life, it's like if they're out of order for like, I'm sorry, I can't be at evening service tonight because my elements are out of balance.
They are.
Yes. Yes.
In other words, they're not animating her anymore in the way
that they were. Yeah. So imbalance, I don't think implies like there's something wrong here. It's just that there's effects, the bodily effects now of this imbalance in terms of maybe Chinese medicine or something. This is not a state of perfect health as we usually define it anymore, but that's not a problem.
Well, only if one thinks you're supposed to live forever.
Exactly, yeah.
And since we don't, then it's not
to me,
it's not something out of balance. It's just that now this is this time. Now this is the time when
the rest. Now is the time. And it also strikes me in Catherine's case particularly, like, interesting that she was, quite healthy physically, and yet she's taken care of a lot of things in her life in the last few years. She really wanted to transmit Dharma to these disciples. She could have said, oh, let's wait a couple of years. The timing was just like within a year, right? This whole transition at the Zen Center, it's kind of like, it's interesting that it was an accident, and yet she's really, the main things that she had to take care of, she has taken care of. She maybe would have liked to maybe do a little bit more, but,
she was excited about the garden. Now the garden looks really beautiful.
Yes. Yes. Very intimate. Yeah. Maybe because it's so basic. It's like we're not talking about all the practical things and like, well, what about this? And the weather's like so and so. It's kind of like, it's like the fundamental basic. We're just here, alive, in this moment. And nothing really can be said. Yeah. Yeah, Patrick.
I just have a feeling that there's always that teaching available, and it's about kind of turning our radios, in the sense that now that that's the only teaching, there's nothing she's teaching it, and we've now turned our radios to the frequency that we can hear it. So it's, I guess for me, it's making me look at other ways that I might appreciate the Dharma or incorporate the Dharma. And because of the ordinariness of it, as Kathy's always pointing out, that it's like it should be all around us all the time, with that frequency of Dharma.
Things just being as they are. Yeah. And of course the Sheen is a good time to get in touch with this wordless simplicity that we like to make very complicated as we sit there serenely with nothing we have to do. Very hard to let it just be as it is. And so my thought for today, since there's more people here today, that is that we not go over this afternoon to sit with Catherine, but go this evening instead of making two trips walking down the road. Do you have any updates, Kathy? From
I was there this morning, mm-hmm. and she's flying her breathing.
Yeah. I mean, this could go on for quite some time.
She could go on for a while, but at some point, having not taken any food or water, at some point.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, you never know.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was my. I mean, we're already filled the room pretty full with less people than this because there's other people there too.
Right, but my experience of being with the people who are there is everybody seems to really appreciate it. They talk with reverence about, and then Mrs. Sheen comes. So it doesn't seem to be an impediment.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you could call Rosie and just check with her.
Yeah.
And ask her, but so far from what I've heard, it's felt really supportive and appropriate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's definitely a great thing to do at least once in the day. So my thought was to go in the evening and do the refuges there as we have been. Johnny?
Yeah, I was happy to see that we're going to do it in the evening and sing the refuges. I didn't know the whole background as to why we're not doing it this afternoon. My strong sense is, as it was yesterday when I spoke, is that the lesson is Catherine is living every moment as she's living it. And in reality, being at Catherine's in a moment is no different than being here in a moment. That's the lesson, I think, that I'm carrying away from it. It's not a special moment to be there. So I would say that if we can be a presence there, in a modest way, that doesn't look like the Mongol hordes, but also be mindful wherever we are of what's going on, then we'll be receiving a lesson there. I don't think you can be in this place and not be influenced by Catherine's teaching life and whatever continues beyond the breath. But this moment in this discussion is no different than being there to me.
You know, we're with her wherever we are physically. Does anybody else have input about this afternoon?
I guess I'll just say that I've been there a lot in a kind of a caretaking and a hostess capacity, and I was looking forward to being there sitting. So, but it, one time was fine.
Yes.
Okay.
I also thought it's a chance to do Dokusan here. I don't think it would be so appropriate to do that over there. And if it's the whole rest of the day. So feel free to give me input on this after the talk too, if you want. But yeah, my sense would be to go in the evening, and also if we do get word that she's died, then it would be especially good to go over there. I think maybe then we would go earlier. Meanwhile, in the realm of the living, lunchtime approaches. The body must be fed and breathed and maintained for as long as as long as the conditions are such. To support this mystery, we dedicate any positive energy arising from this Dharma gathering to the complete well-being, equanimity, and peaceful passage of Karin Sobun Dayosho. May she be sustained deeply by the Dharma. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. Surpassable, I vow to become it.